Citigroup is looking good.
The manufacturing sector, not so much.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, happy Monday to you. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, October 18th. Coming up, we'll check in with an analyst about earnings and some fresh industrial production figures.
A little later, a thief can steal your laptop, but some good can prevail. But first,
Citigroup reported its third consecutive quarterly profit today. Apple and IBM will report after the market closes. Now we turn to the analysis of Julia Coronado, chief U.S. economist at BNP Paribas. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thanks. And let me ask you first, this industrial production number from the Federal Reserve, it says production is down slightly, just 0.2% in September after a slight uptick in August. What's behind that number? What do you make of that?
Well, really, we're seeing the manufacturing sector cool off quite a bit. It was an early driver of growth in the recovery, which is typical, and now it's settling back down to a slower pace. I don't think this morning's number is disastrous, but it does highlight that the manufacturing sector isn't going to be the driver of growth going forward.
Manufacturing sector is not going to be the driver. What about the numbers from Citigroup? They look good. Hasbro, the toy maker, looks good. Halliburton as well. Also, people are expecting Apple's earnings are going to be pretty nice later today. How do you make sense of that?
Well, we are continuing to see relatively good earnings numbers from these big corporations. And I think one of the things that highlights is even though we've seen growth, it's pretty sluggish in the U.S., these are globally diversified companies, and a lot of their revenue gains do come from overseas operations. So what we're seeing is the relative health of the global economy reflected in these U.S. company earnings estimates.
Good to be global. All right. Well, thank you, Julia Coronado, chief U.S. economist at BNP Paribas.
My pleasure.
Let's keep our thoughts on Apple for just a moment. With its earnings report due out later today, the company has had phenomenal success with its iPad tablets and latest generation iPhones. So the big question today, of course, how good can things get for Apple? And here with an answer to that question, perhaps, is Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Good morning, Mitchell.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, we know Apple's expected to have done pretty well in the fourth quarter. How well?
Well, analysts polled by Thomson First Call are predicting earnings just north of $4 a share, up 50% from last year. The stock's at an all-time high. It's hard to find a product that's not doing well for Apple. iPads, the iPhones, Mac computers. Now, other tech companies are also doing well, but Carl Howe at the Yankee Group says Apple is different from the competition.
I think you have to treat Apple as a special case. It's not just another tech company. For one thing, it's a retailer. They have well over 300 stores worldwide now, and they sell as much electronic fashion as they do what we would traditionally call technology.
All right, special case. Can they keep it up, Mitchell?
Well, Apple's beat what analysts predict. This is in terms of their earnings for 17 straight quarters. But they are having one problem. I guess it's what you'd call one of those good problems. They can't seem to make enough iPads and iPhones to meet consumer demand. Going forward, they do face rising competition, especially from Google's Android smartphones. On the other hand, Walmart's going to start selling iPads. There's supposed to be an iPhone eventually for the Verizon system. Mm-hmm. This week, Apple launches new Mac offerings for the corporate market. All of that spells growth.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with us live. Mitchell, thanks.
You're welcome.
Citigroup today said profits topped $2.2 billion. It's the third quarterly result in a row that showed the mega banks made some money. But Citigroup's been through some bad times. It's been trying to recover from the financial crisis by selling off businesses, the brokerage house Smith Barney, to name one. It's also building up its core businesses. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports where the company goes from here.
Citigroup's plan is to go back to old-fashioned banking. Eric Oja follows the banking industry at Standard & Poor's. He says it'll focus more on things like investment banking, wealth management, and retail customers.
They're looking to ramp up in consumer lending and credit cards and eventually in home mortgages. And that would be domestically as well as internationally.
Especially in Asia, which has been one of the most profitable regions for Citi lately.
They are looking to expand in China, especially in the consumer area.
That probably means lots of hiring there as they shed assets and workers in the U.S. Citi is dealing with so much, though, including the mortgage mess. There's no quick solution to its problems. Matt McCormick is a banking analyst at Ball & Gaynor, which is an investment advisory firm.
Much like our economy will take years to recover, I think it will take years for Citigroup to get back to its former strength.
In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, October 18th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. Now the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us right here in the United States. A multi-billion dollar court battle begins today in New York. A private equity firm is slugging it out with Citigroup, the case centering on the purchase of EMI. That's the British-based music label whose catalog includes the likes of Frank Sinatra and the Beatles. It's the intersection of Abbey Road and Wall Street and Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is with us from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So who is suing whom?
Guy Hans, the boss of a private equity firm, is suing Citi. He claims the bank tricked him into buying EMI at the height of the buyout boom in 2007. He says Citi told him there was another bidder, and that was untrue. Guy Hans says, as a result, he overpaid for EMI. He certainly did overpay. He forked out the equivalent of $6.7 billion just before the crash, and EMI has since lost more than $3
billion. That's a lot of money. It sounds like there's a lot at stake in this case, Stephen.
Yes, very much so. I mean, Guy Hans is claiming up to $8 billion in damages. And if he wins, analyst Claire Enders says, many other banks could face hefty lawsuits.
Their transactions would be questioned, and a similar sort of outcome could be imagined for the very large number of deals that were done in 2006, 2007.
Citigroup denies that it misled Guy Hans. The case, however, should shine a fascinating light into some of the darker recesses of high finance at the height of the boom.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
A Chinese official has ratcheted up the rhetoric in a dispute with the U.S. Steelworkers Union. The union filed a complaint last month saying Beijing's subsidies for manufacturers of green energy products are a violation of international trade rules. A top Chinese official said yesterday that the U.S. cannot win this trade fight. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
The union says Beijing discriminates against U.S. clean energy companies that want to sell products in China and gives illegal subsidies to Chinese companies that make wind turbines and solar panels. Wayne Rannick is a union spokesman. He says the subsidies allow the Chinese companies to cut prices for green technology.
They've just seized market share from the U.S. in Europe's wind and solar markets by driving down world prices.
The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative now has 3 months to decide whether to bring a case against Beijing with the World Trade Organization. Erin Ennis is vice president of the U.S.-China Business Council. She says China respects the WTO's decisions.
Where rulings have come down against them, China has a pretty good track record of actually implementing those rulings.
Ennis isn't surprised that a union initiated this case. A steelworkers' complaint last year led to U.S. tariffs on imports of Chinese tires. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
In Beijing today, Communist Party leaders laid out another five-year plan that's set to start next year. Now, they've done the five-year plan thing a dozen times. You got to remember, despite China's unbridled capitalism, people forget it has a planned socialist economy. As Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, drafting the plan provides a rare opportunity for China's policymakers to talk about that country's problems.
Here were some of the goals for the five-year plan ending this year: economic growth, urbanizing the population, and creating jobs. Mission accomplished, says China economist Andy Xie. Now there's another problem the party needs to tackle.
Yeah, I think that the high growth has not led to better social stability. The growth model is at a point that it's not a benefit to the people.
Now that they've got a job and live in a city, many Chinese are wondering when they'll be able to afford a home. Apartments in Shanghai and Beijing are out of reach for many in China's middle class. Xie says it's an example of the widening gap between the rich and poor, a problem that'll need to be tackled within the next 5 years. Economists like Xie say an answer is political freedom. One example, a free press. Without a system of checks and balances, people in power in China end up with all the money. Premier Wen Jiabao has hinted at China's need for more political freedoms recently, but it's unclear whether these will appear in the 12th five-year plan that'll be revealed next March. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You can change your privacy settings all you want on Facebook, but your personal info might still be sent to dozens of advertising companies. That's according to today's Wall Street Journal, which says 10 popular Facebook applications are sending user data to outside companies. Facebook tells the Journal it's on the case. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, October 18th. I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Talks continue today between Cablevision and Fox TV's parent company, News Corporation. Both sides are trying to resolve a dispute that's keeping millions of subscribers in New York and Philadelphia from watching TV. Cablevision viewers already missed the Giants game yesterday and might miss Fox's hit show House tonight. The dispute is yet another fight over how much the cable company will pay Fox to carry them.
Now, the Federal Reserve meets in a couple of weeks trying to figure out what it can do to stimulate the economy. Something we've been hearing about over and over again is quantitative easing. But a lot of folks still don't know what that exactly means. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan, fortunately, is here to help. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
All right, quantitative easing. I mean, it sounds like something Mr. Spock would be warning the Enterprise about. What specifically does it involve?
Well, to those of us in the financial circle, we call it QE2, and I think it's a passenger ship. But what it involves is the Fed going into the markets and buying all sorts of long-term securities, primarily Treasury securities, which runs down the interest rate on them. Now, that's the technical explanation. The simple explanation, which I would give if this were a bar and we were drinking beer, is printing money.
That sounds great, Alan. Printing money. I mean, that's free money. But something tells me printing money can be harmful. I mean, is it too good to be true?
Well, it is. Just like free beer is too good to be true.
Yeah, really.
Printing money means that you're possibly increasing inflation, and you're certainly weakening the dollar. And the dollar has been now dropping for weeks relative to other currencies because people in the markets have anticipated that quantitative easing is coming.
You mentioned lowering interest rates, though. What about jobs? Can quantitative easing do anything to get more jobs created?
Well, the theory is if you lower long-term interest rates, it makes companies and small businesses more eager to expand, more likely to borrow money, and it stimulates the economy. And who knows, that might actually work.
All right. So you mentioned this is QE2. So this is the second time that they've done quantitative easing. Did it work the first time, Alan?
They did it last year and part of this year, and it forced down long-term rates, and it assured the mortgage market that there were people to buy securities. I mean, obviously, things are not great now, but the argument these guys make is that if they hadn't done QE1, things would be even worse than they are now. And the short answer is, who knows?
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan with us. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
We're going to check back in now with someone we've been following since the early days of the Great Recession, Christopher Maraldi, who lost his job as a banker on Wall Street in 2008.
What did they tell you?
Basically that, you know, the bank, there were losses and that my job was being eliminated. I asked twice if it was performance related and they said no.
After 20 years working in finance, Maraldi decided to give other things a try. He spent some time teaching English overseas, and he even did some work for the Census Bureau, all the while sending out resumes to financial companies and not hearing much back. Until now.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
Come on in.
Come on in.
I stopped by his New York apartment last week, and he told me that after 2.5 years of unemployment, he's just taken a job at a bank in Singapore.
Singapore is a smaller market, and right now the opportunities in New York are just not there. It's hard to get back in. But when I had interviewed with them, it was all done by phone, and it was very, I have to say, it reminded me of the way things used to be in banking. just very much focused on the market. And what I liked about them is they told me the difficulties of the job. And I thought that was really honest because, you know, I said I could trust these people. At least they're reasonable.
Almost every time I've spoken with you, you've said basically that Wall Street has not learned the lessons of the financial crisis in 2008. 2 years later, have they learned their lessons?
No, absolutely not, no. Nothing has changed other than the fact that the market is not there. If they could continue to sell assets that were, as I'll quote Lloyd Blankfein, where there's appetite for these assets, the appetite has stopped. That's why they don't produce them. But they were the ones that marketed these assets.
You've been in finance for how many years now altogether?
I started in 1987, right, as the first, well, in my lifetime, it was the first crash in 87.
So more than 20 years.
Yes.
What advice would you have for somebody who's getting into finance this year, the recent college grads that are getting out of school and going right to the big firms on Wall Street?
Follow your heart. If you're really good in other, well, it's probably too late for them because they've already got a degree in finance. But if you're only doing it for the money, that's not all there is.
All right. Well, Chris Maraldi, thanks so much and good luck in Singapore.
Thank you.
And you can hear our previous interviews with Chris Maraldi at marketplace.org.
And finally, from Sweden, a man's laptop bag was stolen while he was doing his laundry. The bag had his computer in it, wallet, date book, and library card.
Well, while he was at the police station reporting the crime, the bag was returned with everything in it but the laptop and library card. And a week later, the robbery victim got a USB memory stick in the mail with all the files from his computer.
That's amazing. Which would, of course, restore your faith in humanity until you realize the thief still has your computer and your library
card.
Indeed. Yes. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.